Okay, here we go. Everybody set in the booth? Good. Level set? Yes, talent always ready. Put it down in the book, episode 146. 146. Three S's, Jim. Here we go. Star, smile, and strong. Ready? Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNPlus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted for your podcasting pleasure, your binge-worthy buffet, if you will. And don't forget the landing page. You go on WGNPlus.com and you hit the prompt in the entertainment section, and then there's another prompt for Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and there you will find all previous 145 episodes, which can only mean one thing. This is episode 146. Thank you for your clicking and your downloading and your scrolling and whatever it is that you do to find us on a weekly basis. As I said for many times, it's 168 hours in a week. All I'm asking for is one. That is not a big price to pay. And if you do give me that 1 hour a week, I will send you this adorable blanket. So, as we begin to jump right into episode 146, we've got some house cleaning and housekeeping issues to tend to here. I initially had a topic, and then inadvertently, a topic seemed to fall in my lap after talking to one of our friends and regular contributors to the podcast in our Pop Culture Club little nook of the podcast, Emily Armanetti. Are you there, Emily?
I'm here.
Yes. So, I was going to, and we touched upon this to some extent, I think, last week or a couple of weeks ago, about the rise of Freddie Mercury. And, I mean, my gosh, this has really been, I don't think anybody associated with the Bohemian Rhapsody movie ever expected the movie to have this much of a success and an impact, and to be so rewarded across the board by so many of the established movie award organizations.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think especially because the movie, it wasn't really getting like amazing. Like
I never saw any review anywhere higher than 2.5 stars.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean that is. And I don't know what you would. I mean, I don't know if it's just some kind of rolling thunder with the performance, in the lead role of Freddie Mercury, or if it's the Freddie Mercury, aura
halo effect.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but it certainly. Here's a sobering fact, which I will take with me whenever I talk about this. Bohemian Rhapsody, the film, has won more Oscars now than The Godfather.
Really?
Yeah. So.
Oh.
Yeah. So you tell me what's going on, and we will talk about this a little later if we have some time. But all I have to say is. No host, no problem.
Right.
I didn't miss. So that's, yeah, I have been calling for no host for many years, and I think my point has been proven.
I did predict that you would have a much better Oscars experience.
Yeah.
I know it's been a. You've
been. Well, what did you miss? What did you miss?
And you know what? I think actually, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I think kicking off the show with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Maya Rudolph, they came out, they made us laugh a little bit. They're not the hosts.
Yeah,
know.
They made that painfully
Although,
clear.
Maybe they're priming them for, like,
right.
I think they would be great hosts, you know, but.
But what, but for what? I mean, what,
right.
what would they
really
just.
Need, you know, it still went over. Did you notice that? It still went over
yeah.
time.
Yeah, they did right? go by about 20
so
minutes.
So I had to do the whole, I had to DVR it because I had plans and I was like, oh shoot, when I made these plans,
this
I
is
forgot.
Your Super Bowl.
No, I know. But I knew I was going to be home within a reasonable amount of time of it starting. So. But I had to DVR it. And then after I hit the, and after I did the DVR, okay, Oscars 2019
right.
broadcast, whatever it says on the
yeah, did
menu.
Did you extend?
I realized, I went, oh, wait a second. Yeah. I thought, yeah. oh, I know they're trying to keep it to time this year, but I better just.
Right. That's
just
what I did as well.
So, but you know, on my DVR, you can't, I couldn't really extend it, but what you have to do is record the program that's airing after
right.
it. So like whatever,
exactly.
whatever weird.
Yeah.
Sunday night news type program was
right.
on. I recorded that and it did. It extended into that extra. So even without the host, it was still a really long
Well,
podcast.
What I'm saying is that what did you miss? I mean, to
right,
your point,
right.
they brought them out at the beginning and they did a little shtick
yeah.
and then it's on with the awards. And
right.
and so I don't know what a host would have done except to bog things down, and then they would have done the obligatory you know, shtick and skit that they now have to do, you know, bringing in tour buses or...
Right.
Or
ordering pizzas.
Ordering, you know, or giving shots, you know, flu shots and all that other BS. So I have to say, I think that as a show, it moved along.
Okay.
And, and like I said, I've always said, I never would have suggested the non-host if I felt that the hosting job had not become diluted.
Right.
I mean, I understand, as we talked about, that used to be, and that job used to be held in the highest of esteem. And you can argue about, you know, in retrospect, people would say, well, who's that or who cares? But in past years, you had, at the time, people that were at the height of the entertainment and show business world, like Johnny Carson and Bob Hope. And that job.
Well, and then when I was, you know, when we were younger, you know, Billy Crystal and
yeah.
Goldberg. But see, but think about it like this. Back then, like even in the 80s and actually even in the 90s, I mean, what else was there to watch on a Sunday night? You know?
Yeah, there was only really three channels. Yeah, I mean, even in the world, even initially in the world of cable.
Yeah,
it was still a big deal. I mean, you can't argue that today there is such you know, a variety of places to go. I think award shows overall have lost their sheen. I mean, it's become, I would say, in the last 20 years, it's become much more about fashion and much more about little things that happen. Than the actual awards themselves. Sadly, I think there used to be a time when it was a big deal. And now, I mean, if you asked people who won last year, would people remember that Frances McDormand won last year? I don't think they would.
Well, only if they remember. Oh, well, yeah. Only if they realized it when she came out.
No, no. I mean, throughout the year. If you ask somebody in July.
Right.
Who won the Academy Award this year or for last year's movies? They would not have known. So, and I hate to, you know, to sound all, you know, in my day, but you know, once again, I do believe that the award show in general, one reason why it has become less popular is because you've got a whole generation that was raised where trophies were really kind of de-emphasized. And
right.
winners were de-emphasized. And so why should that, you know, we used to grow up and there was this sense of competition and this sense of who will win. And I don't really think that now the a younger generation really gets into the competition of it because they didn't grow up with competition.
Right.
You know, I hate to sound all sociological, but I really believe there. I don't know. You can't put a blanket on that, but I really think that as you watch the Grammys, as now you watch the Oscars, as you watch some of these other shows, I mean, the Grammys are a concert.
Yeah.
I mean,
a concert. Full of artists that we don't even...
Well, yeah. But regardless of whether you know them or not, I mean, because somebody knows them, that's an age thing. But my point is, I was watching it for a while, and I said, are they going to give an award out?
Right.
I mean, isn't this an award show? I mean, every so often, and then that happens so quickly, and it's like, okay, wait a minute, now here comes a cool duet. It's like, you know. So, anyway, I think I think the Oscars and all of these other shows are going to have to rethink. I don't know what more you can do. I mean, there's a format for it. What more can you do? But I think the Oscars are trying, and I do think, too, that, whether it was meant to, or I think it was, initially it was meant to be some time filler for the E! Network 20 or so years ago with Joan Rivers.
Yeah.
And how do we...
Meaning like all the red carpet.
All the red... I mean, the red carpet. There was no... There was a red carpet.
Oh, but Joan Rivers created the red carpet.
That's what I mean.
Now it's like, yeah.
Everybody, once again, thinks that has always been, some kind of mainstay. And that is relatively new. And and it started with Joan Rivers actually making fun. It was now. It's this, oh, my God, it's this maudlin. Everybody's just so, kissing each other's butts, and they're all just fawning over another. What was so great about Joan Rivers is that she was actually kind of poking fun at the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
But then...
There were people who I'm pretty sure would not stop to talk to her
exactly.
for a long time because they didn't really have enough of a sense of humor
about
themselves.
Or she was saying, oh, my God, did you see her?
Yeah.
But then the idea came, well, wait a minute. If Joan is going to do this in some sarcastic way, that's still not a bad thing to see. We could do this straight and find, some fashion people and do it in a real way. And then all of a sudden now that's what all these these award shows, in my view, really exist now for the red carpet shows. The show is almost secondary in nature, which is sad.
Right.
And as I said, when you look at a movie now that unless now they're going to rewrite history about Bohemian Rhapsody, but like you said, everything on the internet is there. And the initial reviews for that movie when it first came out were definitely, the acting was amazing. Mm-hmm. And this guy channeled Freddie Mercury, no question.
Right.
But as a film, it doesn't really do anything. It's okay. And for it to have been nominated for Best Picture, for Queen to have opened the whole telecast itself.
I know. What did you think of that? I'm curious to know what you thought of that performance.
It felt to me, it felt like a tribute band. It felt like a band.
Flat.
And what was ironic was it was the band being its own tribute band.
Right.
It's one thing when you've got a bunch of guys who just really like the band and they try to recreate the sound.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Queen is in the position of not having Freddie Mercury around. And so, yes, right. While Brian May with the big hair and the guitar sound is still there and things like that, Queen was always Freddie Mercury. And so it is kind of strange when you see a guy like Adam Lambert who, no question, he's got the chops.
Yeah.
He's got a voice.
But it's really tough shoes to fill.
Yeah. And
especially in a live performance.
Well, and not only that, but at the end of the day, he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know whether to be Freddie Mercury. Now he doesn't know whether to be Freddie Mercury. He doesn't know whether to be Adam Lambert. And he doesn't know to be, what's the name of the actor?
Should he be Rami Malek?
Yeah, should
he
be Rami Malek?
Right.
I mean, now who should he be? Now he's got a third person. Before he was just battling with Freddie Mercury. Now he's got a battle with Rami Malek.
Right.
In terms of who do I act like? It's like I said, Queen has been struggling with the Freddie Mercury question for 20, almost 30 years now. He died in 1991. I mean, it's almost 30 years. And they've been struggling with this. They've had George Michael sing with them in the past. And he had a great, you know, George Michael had a great voice and was a huge fan of Queen. He grew up in that era. But he was a, you know, he was a star in his own right. They had a ridiculous choice at one point. This guy named Paul Rogers, who classic rock fans will know as the lead singer of Bad Company. And he's and Paul Rogers has a very cool voice, but not Freddie Mercury voice at all.
Right. Well, I mean, scientists have proven that Freddie Mercury probably has the best, like, vocal range in the history.
Oh, really? Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they were saying that, like, if you study opera singers' voices, like, apparently his frequency goes even higher. Like, if they when they study the frequency of the voices. So you can't. Yeah. I mean, who's ever really going to. Right. I mean, if actual scientists can, like, show that, you know, that Freddie Mercury has more range than opera singers,
right,
then, you know, who really has a chance?
Well, I mean, except, but this guy, Paul Rogers, I mean, my gosh, if you ever listen to Bad Company, I mean, he's got a low voice. He's got a deep voice. And so to have even, I mean, I'm sure they were friends with him, but that was just a weird coupling because there is no way that even can come close to duplicating the histrionics and, you know, of, you know, and the as you said, the upper reaches of of Kenny or Freddie Mercury's voice, and then along comes American Idol with Adam Lambert, and he certainly fits the bill and the costume. You know,
yes,
he's got a good voice. You know, I don't know if he's homosexual or not, but he certainly.
Oh, Adam Lambert?
Yeah, he is, right?
I mean, I think he's
So I'm just saying he fits the model much better.
Yeah,
and now
I
that's
think he
why
came
they
out,
are
like during his Idol days.
Yeah,
when he was on American
Idol.
Well,
I don't these days. I'm afraid to say anything about anybody.
You don't want to out anyone.
Yeah, in case not that I would know, but but you know, so he does. I mean, of the people that seem to be around, he certainly is a good substitute. But that is what he is, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that, oh my gosh, I mean, they have found somebody now that can really fill the shoes. They can find somebody that can wear the shoes. But I don't know if he necessarily fills the shoes. But certainly, Queen is going to go out on a big tour now. And there are enough young people who know Adam Lambert and are fans of his who don't even know who Freddie Mercury was and were never born when he was alive. So they will, I'm sure, accept Adam Lambert as the substitute. But if you were somebody that, and I saw Queen one time perform, and I was always a fan of Queen's, and so if you remember the real deal and things like that, you certainly take Adam Lambert with a grain of salt. But I have to say that. And I said I wasn't going to talk about this first, but we wound up talking about it anyway. I still am really, I mean, it is a, it's an amazing, I don't know whether it was organic, I don't know if it was orchestrated, but it has been an amazing either emergence, reemergence, rediscovery, I don't know what you even call it. I don't know if it was
Renaissance.
Renaissance, yeah, I guess that is the best word. Of the Freddie Mercury image and everything. And I don't know if it was just a combination of YouTube and different people talking about him. And I think, obviously, once again, in the last 25 or so years, you cannot deny the influence and impact that the gay culture has had on pop culture in general. And so here was Freddie Mercury. A tragic figure dying of AIDS. I mean, there's. I mean, who knows? You know, the sad part is that with I don't know what kind of you know, diagnosis he had and when he found out about it, but I'm sure in today's world he would not have died.
Well, yes, and actually, a while back, maybe it was around the time that Bohemian Rhapsody came out. I remember reading an article about his I think he was diagnosed a couple of years before he actually died.
He didn't announce it. Yeah, until he died.
And so this is the thing. I think part of his I think there's always a mystique about artists who die before their time, you know, especially like someone who's that as big as he was. But with him, you know, it was like, well, for starters, he was sick for a couple of years, at least, I think, before people even knew he was. There were years of speculation even about his sexuality, but he was very private, you know, about that. And, of course, his health. And there were rumors that, you know, I remember reading this. There were rumors for a couple of years about his health because he was looking, you know, he was starting to look like he was sick. He was getting thinner. He was getting gaunt. But, you know, he didn't publicly confirm that he had AIDS until the day before he died.
Yeah.
It's a statement, which, you know, is a great thing to do because I think in the end, as private as he wanted to be, I think he felt a responsibility that he could call attention to something that was, at the time was, you know, something we desperately needed attention on, you know, the AIDS epidemic. We needed people to start doing something about it. And we needed to raise public awareness. And so I think he kind of, you know, he put his privacy aside. I mean, this man is dying. He's on his deathbed. And he makes this announcement, I think, to help call attention to it and create awareness. And then he dies the next day. So I think there's also this sense that he just kind of slipped through our fingers. You know what I mean? Because
realize that 30 years ago, I mean, and you know, it's hard to believe that it's been 30 years, but you know, once again, we are in a very myopic society. We don't really have much sense of the average person doesn't have much sense of history, and certainly people in their younger years don't. If it didn't happen 2 years ago, they don't even know it occurred. And so, but you know, to your point, you know, AIDS and homosexuality was still a very controversial topic in terms of acceptance and those people. George Michael didn't come out until he got caught, you know, in the park in bushes.
No, see, I always disagree with you about this because I think he came out he released Freedom 90. But
He did, but he didn't. He did, but he didn't.
It was, I think it was something that easily could have been missed, but I think there were lots of people at the time who recognized that as his way of coming out.
Okay, but he didn't say it.
He didn't go on the cover of People magazine.
Right, well, that's my point.
I'm gay, but...
Right, and that's my point. And today, you don't need to do that because that, you know, that big pronouncement isn't needed or isn't even demanded anymore because... at least into some areas of the mainstream society, that's who you are. You don't need to. But, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it was a big deal. And to your point about, you know, being, you know, sort of a spokesperson or somebody to, you know, to be someone that is well known to bring attention, there were a lot of people that in the movement who were out and very aggressive into trying to get gay rights and gay lifestyles and certainly an attention to fighting AIDS out on the mainstream, those people were very upset that many high-profile entertainers who had a lot of pull and who had big audiences still were kind of closeted because they were afraid of the overall reaction to that. It was not. I mean, people forget. In the Clinton administration, the mid-90s, we were still doing the don't ask, don't tell.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's like, you know, see no evil, hear no evil, you know, speak no evil. I mean, that was our view on things. Okay, that's fine. Just don't tell me about it.
Right.
You know, and so that's say 20 years later. And so, you know, this is still all relatively new, and look at how fast it's gone from simply people not having to, you know, wear a banner to gay marriage. It's been an amazing trajectory over the last, you know, 10 years. But So, yeah, I mean, I think it's, like I said, I don't know if Queen themselves, I mean, I think the fact that Queen has just always been around over the last 30 years, they've found ways to try to reinvent themselves and keep their music alive despite losing, you know, the key figure in that. But, I mean, at this point now, I mean, you know, everybody's a Queen fan.
Right.
I mean, I don't know.
I mean,
which is fine, but my point is, they were a big band. Don't get me wrong. As I said, I was around when, you know, Killer Queen first came out, their first song in the mid 70s. They always were much more popular in Europe.
Oh, sure, yes.
And I think that had to do with just the fact that in Europe and especially in the UK, homosexuality was much more, you know, out in the open. And accepted than it was here in the United States, and you know the UK is known for loving, you know, guys in drag and everything, that whole thing. So they were always more popular internationally than they perhaps were here in the United States. But when you look at you know their chart success and everything like that, I mean, my gosh, you know, their albums were number one. They had number one singles up through.
Oh, do you know? I think they're the only band in like rock and roll history where every single member of the band was responsible for writing a number one hit song.
Oh, within the band?
You know, usually it's like one or two guys.
Yeah, right.
In the band who kind of do, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently, Queen, and I can't map the song to each member of the band, but they are, yeah, that's I read that. I think it was back when I was reading that when Bohemian Rhapsody came out, I was reading about there was a lot of press about them in general at that time, but
yeah, no, it's an amazing,
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's an amazing, as I said, I don't know if this,
but you
was...
know what too, I think, I mean, obviously they have this amazing catalog, they had a lot of hits, they have a really diverse catalog when you think about it. I mean, think of like, actually, their music was like, you know, they had a little bit of opera influence. They had a little bit of like the whole like kind of rockabilly thing with like Crazy Little Thing Called Love. They had like all everything in between. You know, they had the rock and roll. They had the rock anthems, you know.
But, oh, yeah. They well, if any kind of performer that has been around for 30 or 40 years, whether it's a band or an individual, they have to reinvent themselves. And Queen even... you know, once again, they were initially viewed as a hard rock band, whatever that meant, in the early 70s. And then they were, you know, a pop band. Then all of a sudden, Bohemian Rhapsody just broke every boundary. Nobody even knew what it was.
Right.
But they were basically, in the United States at least, considered a hard rock band. They were not any kind of campy or... glam rock. They were, you know, even a pop band, even though they had pop singles, they still, all of them had that, because of the Brian May guitar, they all had a harder edge. And, you know, to their songs with the guitar sound and Freddie Mercury's voice. But they were always played on, you know, hard rock / you know, classic rock, whatever you want to call it, stations. They were played on the pop stations when they had hit songs, but a lot of the album-oriented radio stations used to always play deep cuts. In fact, one of my favorite songs, my favorite Queen song is one that probably most people have never even heard. And it's from their News of the World album, and it's called Spread Your Wings. So if you've never heard of that song, go on the Google or on the YouTube.
Or on Spotify.
I don't even know what that is. And... you know, but Spread Your Wings. It's a great song. And it's a great Freddie Mercury vocal. It's a classic Queen song. And I think it was on the same album that had like We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions. And so those were the big songs. But as I said, they used to play deep cuts on album oriented rock stations and the songs that you did not hear all the time. And I don't know why they never released Spread Your Wings, but it's a great Queen song. But regardless, what I'm saying is, but then they became a pop band in the 80s with little Crazy Little Thing Called Love and another one, Bites the Dust, which was kind of like a disco song. Even if it was the last days of disco. You know, right. And then in the mid 80s, early 80s, then they had Under Pressure with David Bowie. And then they actually went full-blown kind of synthesizer into the mid-80s. And then, of course, they had Radio Gaga, which was never a big hit song here, but which was huge in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then came Live Aid. And I think, as I said...
Well, and this is the thing, though. Okay, so they've got this amazing catalog, but then they have these, like, cultural touch points that have become iconic, like the Live Aid performance, you know, where they were really, of all the performers and the artists that performed there, you know, it was like Queen, I think they were the only ones who really grasped like this, how truly global this platform was. And they had this show-stopping performance, you know, where they had everyone in the stadium, you know, clapping along in sync. I mean, who can really do that other than Freddie Mercury?
Well, but think about, but you have to, what you have to think about too is that, and people, you know, when they see it now, they're not realizing it. Queen at that time in 1985 was popular, but they were not the rock gods anymore. And you have to remember, when you look at that video of them from Live Aid, the real one, they're playing when it's still light out.
Yeah.
They were on in the afternoon. Now, at these big events like that, they always save the biggest acts for last.
Right.
So
yeah,
if
the
you,
headliner.
Yeah,
sure.
So if you watch all of the Live Aid coverage, you will see the final 2 or 3 hours were filled with Dire Straits and Elton John and Paul McCartney and all of these people, and yet Queen clearly stole the show, but no one expected Queen to steal the show. They put them on because they were popular. They were from England, and sure, you know, there's no doubt they were a popular band.
Well, and Bob Geldof, I think, was putting that whole thing together, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he was.
But my point is, nobody expected Queen. Nobody expected Queen to steal the show. If they did, they would have put them on at, you know, at 9 p.m. They put them on at 2 or 3 in the afternoon.
Now you've just described why I get mad when I go to Riot Fest and Liz Phair is at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm like, why do I have to get there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to see Liz Phair?
Right.
To my mind, she should be way further back
in
the lineup.
Yeah. So that's what was even the reason why, in retrospect, you know, I mean, when you watch it now, 35 years later, you know, like you said, they've got everybody's clapping their hands, and, you know, Freddie Mercury is strutting around the stage. He's got the whole stadium in the palm of his hand. So it's that on its own. If you didn't know anything about the day, the event, or anything, and you just saw that performance, you would say, wow. You know, there's somebody that's...
Yeah, of course.
But what even elevated it more was, at the time, as I said, no, oh, here comes Queen. That wasn't like, ooh, ooh, ooh. It was sort of like, okay, fine, but when are the Thompson twins going to come on? You know? And so that's what even I remember watching that and being blown away, like, wow, where did this come from? I mean, and I was a Queen fan, and I was like, oh, this will be cool to see Queen. I never expected just to see, and to your point, which is true, I mean, most of the people that performed there probably did not rehearse or look at it like it was a big deal. Clearly, whether it was Freddie Mercury in his own sense of showmanship and world audience and savvy in that way, whether they rehearsed it or whether they looked at it differently, they clearly were out there to steal the show.
Yeah.
You know, they were primed and this wasn't just like, oh, okay, well, let's just play our songs and we haven't rehearsed in a while, but who cares? We're just happy to be here and happy to be a part of this event. I think Queen clearly saw this as a major opportunity to reestablish themselves, which they did. And sadly, you know, within 5 or 6 years, he was dead, you know.
Right.
But, yeah, like I said, I have nothing against it. Because I said, I've always been a Queen fan, and I have quite a few of their albums, and there's I used to love Queen just because many of their initial albums were all named after Marx Brothers movies.
Oh, really?
Day at the Races, A Night at the Opera. Those were all those were all Marx Brothers. And then, of course, you know, they made a big splash in the late 70s, early 80s with Fat Bottom Girls and the that that song because there was a poster in the album of all these naked women on bikes.
Oh, gosh.
And that was a big deal. And there's even the video for Fat Bottom Girls. You know, that was like that was so taboo or so crazy. So, I mean, they certainly, you know, they had their moments. I certainly believe that now, in many ways, history is being rewritten, and that's fine. And there are many people that are younger who are assessing Freddie Mercury based on the image and the hype of him more than what was perhaps at the time. I mean, I think he is certainly, you know, getting a great benefit of the doubt, which is fine. He was a great performer.
And that's the thing. And it's like I said, you know, I feel like that happens a lot with artists that where you have the sense that they were gone too soon. You know, I think everyone, we could say the same thing maybe about Janis Joplin or Jimi Hendrix or Kurt Cobain, you know, I don't know. I mean, look, as I've, Kurt Cobain's a great example. I mean, they've done a couple of documentaries about him. Wait till someday there's a biopic. You know, I think, yeah, and a lot is made of what a genius he was. And, you know, I was around. I mean, look, I was at my, well, when Nirvana first came on the scene, that was like, you know, like I was in high school, almost college. My whole life revolved around music at that point. You know, my friends and I, that's what we did. You know, we went to see live shows and we enjoyed music. And I don't know. I mean, Nirvana was good, but I feel like now he's like considered an icon, and maybe he is, and maybe that's rightfully so. But again, I think this stuff, when an artist is gone too soon, I think that there is a tendency to look back with rose-colored glasses, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, there's and Kurt Cobain is a good example because when he died, there is a certain, to your point, you know, like, say, your age group and many people, you know, they consider him, you know, a god now. And there's a lot of, you know, comparisons between Kurt Cobain and John Lennon, who also, even though he was 40,
right,
that was still relatively young, and the tragedy.
Well, he had put out a lot of music. I mean, let's think about this. If Kurt Cobain had 10 more years to put out music, even, you know, who knows how many? I mean, he could have put out a lot of great music. He could have put out some crappy stuff too. You know,
thing. Everybody, know. I mean, to your point, when you mentioned Janis Joplin, you're talking about Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison and you know, Jimi Hendrix, who were like, you know, the big three of the early rock era, who all died at age 27 in a relatively short period of time, and everybody looks at what they left behind and said, "Oh my!" I mean, yeah. When you look at what they left behind, your first inclination is to say, "Oh my God, could you imagine what would have happened if they just continued to live?" And you make the excellent point of, "Hey, they also could have sucked."
Right. Well, because put it this way, Nirvana, you know, put out three albums.
Right.
Three albums, which brought not. Well, we won't count the MTV acoustic. Remember,
right,
MTV
right.
used to do that.
Three.
Unplugged.
Yeah. No, sure, three studio albums.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know,
he was only 27.
Right.
I mean,
so, you know, you just,
well, that's why, that's why a lot of older people were bristling at the John Lennon comparison, because it's like, well, you're going to compare a guy that put out three albums to a guy that changed music.
Right. Exactly. And then even back to Freddie Mercury, you know, I mean, Freddie Mercury, even though he died young, I mean, he was 45. Freddie Mercury was not that much older than I am now when he died, which is kind of crazy. But he still put out, he had a whole catalog.
Oh, definitely.
Of music,
yeah.
That you could go back and you know, sort of judge and judge for yourself.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure right now, I mean, I'm excited because in May there's going to be this Elton John movie called Rocket Man. And and I've seen some, you know, the trailers from it, and I don't know what it's going to be like in terms of a film or, you know, the quality of the film. But certainly, from what I've seen from the trailer, visually, it looks great. They've done a great job of capturing, you know, his era and his flamboyance and even some of the, you know, the different happenings of his life that I know about, which people will now, you know, learn about. Now, I know that it is...
Wait, real quick, did you hear that Elton and the actor who's
Taron Egerton, they sang Tiny Dancer,
At an Oscars party.
Yeah, at Elton's Oscar party. Yeah, well, they had just...
Oh, yeah, I guess that is... I forget he has his annual Oscars party.
Yeah, they did that at the Oscar party, and that's online. You can see that. And he does and apparently he's going to sing in this film. I mean, it's not going to be dubbed. It's not going to be Elton's voice. It's going to be his voice. And they have shown him in the trailer singing, and he's got a pretty good voice. I mean, he doesn't try to mimic Elton.
He can't.
The tones are somewhat the same, but I think... But what's going to be interesting about, like we said, so Bohemian Rhapsody, as a film itself, was not rated very high. It's going to be very interesting to see how this film does with critics and audiences, just because visually, as I said, and certainly the songs will be there. But I do know that... And they are. If you look at the trailer, and if you even look at the poster that's been shown around, they are billing this as a fantasy story. And so,
what does that mean?
Yeah. So what that means is that this will certainly, you know, talk about his life. But and I've known people that have seen the script. I mean, the script's been around for at least 7 or 8 years. And so what's going to be interesting is see if the public is ready for this and if they are sophisticated enough to get it. But if you remember Moulin Rouge, the film Moulin Rouge, which was a big hit.
Yeah, Baz Luhrmann.
Yeah, now that was a elevated reality of what was going on during the 20s in Paris with Toulouse-Lautrec and everything else. And so it's written in that kind of perspective, in that this is not going to be a straight, and here's what happened in 1952 when he was 10, and here's what happened it's going to tell the story, but it's also going to tell it in a very elevated reality, kind of almost fantasy reality. And so it's going to be, it's going to be rated R too. At least it was. Now with the popularity of Bohemian Rhapsody, I don't know if they've decided, wait a minute, we need to, you know, that's going to now, you know, create more maybe anticipation and about this. So maybe they'll rethink that, because the original idea was for this to be a very warts and all story. And Elton was like, I want everything to be told. I'm not trying to sugarcoat anything. And I want it to be out there. So it was initially going to be rated R. I would assume that's going to be the case, but who knows? The studio might rethink that now, given the amazing success of Bohemian Rhapsody, because as I said, the same director who finished Bohemian Rhapsody, because the original director was fired. The original director,
Bryan Singer.
Yeah, the second director who finished that is directing Rocketman.
Okay.
So we'll see.
I mean, you have to think, if Elton is involved, you have to think it's going to be pretty good, right? Because,
well, I don't know. I'm just saying,
doesn't seem to be like someone who... He does not seem like he would shy away from being really critical.
No. I'm just saying, from an audience standpoint, are they going to be able to get it? Like, what, you know, the way this story is told, and the way, like, I've already seen online, because they've you know, released photos, and like I said, they've released this trailer, and on some of these Elton John, you know, Facebook sites or fan sites, they're already complaining. You know, the fans, the ones who know all this, are complaining, like, well, he didn't wear that at that time, And oh, that, oh, he never, that he never, I have never, he never wore that. Or that right. was the, you know, and it's like they're not going to get caught up on the little insignificant details. They are going to tell the story in a much broader way, just to say, hey, here's Elton's flamboyance.
Right.
We're not going to recreate every little detail, but we want to get across is the flamboyance and the debauchery and the drugs. And so I think that that's going to be the challenge. Can a mainstream audience watch it from that perspective as opposed to saying, well, this could never have happened? That's not the point of this.
Right. And I think with biopics, that's the way to go, because otherwise, if you're doing it, you know, the exact costume to a T and the, this, it, then it, it can, the danger is it becomes a caricature of that person, you know?
Yeah, no.
And so it's better. It's almost better to do broad brushstrokes than to try to.
I understand that. I just don't know if the mainstream audience, I mean, here, to give you an example, and I'm not trying to, you know, to cast aspersions here, but I think it's interesting. So when recently Peter Tork of the Monkees died, right?
Yeah.
So I was joking around and I said, oh, well, geez, now there's only two Beatles left and two Monkees left.
Yeah.
So on my Facebook page, I found a picture of Ringo and McCartney together, and I found a picture of Mike Nesmith and Mickey Dolenz, who are now the two surviving Monkees. Mm-hmm. And I said, wow, you know, the death of Peter Tork got me to thinking, you know, why, you know, these two, and you know, in 1967, I believe, the Monkees outsold the Beatles.
That's kind of crazy.
And
when you
I
really
and,
think about it.
And I believe that the Monkees toppled Sgt. Pepper from the number one spot. Okay. So my point is, say what you will about the Monkees, but the Monkees were very popular and they sold a lot of records.
Oh, sure they were.
Yeah. So my point is, so I was saying, well, you know, you've got Paul on bass, Ringo on drums, Mickey on vocals, and Mike Nesmith on guitar. So they were both popular at the same time, so maybe we should have a Beatles Monkey mashup tour.
Oh, gosh.
Because now, this was not meant in any serious manner, right? I'm just throwing it out as something funny and interesting, like, well, you know, now there's two and two, and there's, so I said, oh, should we call them, you know, the former four instead of the Fab Four? You know, and the way it worked out, which was funny, was how, okay, you did actually have four guys filling each spot. You know what I mean? Even though Mickey Dolenz played the drums, but he was, you know, the quasi-lead singer. So I'm like, you could actually do this. It's stupid and silly, but, you know, you could pretend that you're really serious. Well, so I put that on my Facebook page. It was a joke, right?
Right.
And a majority of people got it. And said, oh, yeah, they could be the Munkles or the Beatleys or the Beaties. You know, I mean, so they were, you know, and they were, you know, going, but some people were like, no, this is a terrible idea. You know what I mean? I think I lost Emily. Did I lose Emily? I may have lost Emily. I think I did. Did I lose you, Emily? Let's see if I lost Emily. Yeah, it says that the call has ended. I wonder what happened. So here you are hearing the behind the scenes. And we've got some music of the rigging phone. Da, da. And I'm not sure what's going on. Good morning, everybody. I'm not. Are you there? Emily is unavailable. Well, you are hearing the exact real. Hey, good morning, everybody. Is that Emily?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost you.
I know. I don't know. It's just disconnected. I think it was the signal. I don't know.
Yeah. But anyway.
Okay.
So my point is, everybody, I don't know how much you heard, but my point is, I this was not meant to be real. This was a funny little joke. And just something to post that, you know.
And everyone gets upset.
And everybody, and so this is a terrible idea.
Right.
And the egos would never allow it. No, no. And I'm like, oh my God. Do you honestly believe that A, I think the monkeys and the Beatles should get together? And B, do you honestly think that I think that they even would?
Right.
You know, so this is my point in terms of, you know, I'm out there in my mind and in my perspective saying, okay, this will be kind of a fun little stupid thing just to put out there. And you know, it's got little bits of irony in it. And it's something right off the heels of the Peter Tork death. And it actually does work out. You've got the four people that would fill all the roles for a band. And so blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's a nice little quick little thing to say. Wouldn't this be funny? And yet some people took it as gospel. Like, I meant, oh, yes, let's go.
Right.
So this is what I'm, you know, thinking about. And to your point, my whole point about bringing Rocket Man up was with the, I mean, don't forget, this was already in the can. You know, Rocket Man was being shot before Bohemian Rhapsody was even released.
Right.
But now, given, so that's why it's able to come right on the heels of it, which could be good or could be bad, because now Bohemian Rhapsody is kind of the new standard. And when Rocket Man...
But that could be good, because once again, despite the awards, it didn't get the best reviews.
Oh, I understand that. But now it's been elevated to another... Whether it didn't get good reviews or not, it's been elevated to a different level. And so now people are going to say, I guarantee you, in the first paragraph of every review you read, you're going to hear or see the one sentence that's going to read, unlike Bohemian Rhapsody, or similar to Bohemian Rhapsody, that will be there.
Right.
That's going to be there, regardless. Now, what's going to be interesting, to what I wanted to make my original point was, if you don't think, because now I understand there's a David Bowie movie being made, if you don't think Courtney Love is sitting there going, okay,
oh, I'm sure.
Let's get the Kurt Cobain. I mean, now you're going to see the, because now Bohemian Rhapsody has proven, and Hollywood is really a bunch of lemmings. They follow the leader. So you are going to see, I think, until there's too many and they're bad, you're going to see an onslaught now of rock and roll biographies. And there's been one that's been hanging around for at least 20 years. And you mentioned her earlier, was there's always been talk about a Janis Joplin.
There has been. And there were even, like, over time, there were even, like, big actresses that were attached to it.
And they...
But yeah, you're and right. They never really...
And it's never been made. And I guarantee you, you're going to see that. Although, I don't know about that one, just because I don't know. There's two things. There's something going for it, and there's something not going for it. Going for it is that we are certainly in a female-oriented, female empowerment, you know, culture now. And so Janis Joplin was one of the first females to make it big in a boys' rock world. So she certainly has that as an inspirational role model of a woman doing it in a man's world back in the 60s. So that's a powerful message that certainly would resonate today. On the other side of the coin is that, you know, she died 50 years ago. And so does she still resonate with the crowd? I mean, Freddie Mercury, you know, is even on the border. Elton, you know, he's still around. So that's why, you know, he still can do that. You know, Bowie died at a young age, like you're saying, even though he was almost 70. You know, he's...
Well, but he, that was recent, you know, that was just like in the last...
So my point is that, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think that the Janis Joplin thing can certainly work, as I said before, because of the female bent on that. But I also don't know, and don't forget, you know, and with the rise of the whole, you know, progressive movement, you know, a hippie kind of movie would certainly go in, you know, would do well, too, to speak to the younger kind of audience that's kind of into a more liberal-minded, you know, outlook. So that could happen. I wouldn't be surprised if all of a sudden that gets on the front burner again, because like you said, that thing, and there have been so many actresses that were attached to that, and now it's going to have to be someone completely different and new, because...
Most of these actresses are too old.
Yeah, now they're all in their 50s, you know, and 40s.
Because she also died in, like, what, when she was, like, 27?
27, they were all 20, Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix were all 27.
And wasn't Kurt Cobain, too? Yeah.
And he was 27.
They were all...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, but like I said, if you don't think Courtney Love, who certainly has a way with marketing, isn't thinking about, okay, how am I going to, or when am I going to make the Kurt Cobain movie? Believe me. I wouldn't even be surprised to some extent if you start to see an Elvis movie. I mean, you know, at this point, you know, who's Elvis to people?
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, as I said, now this will, just like what happens in Hollywood, once a certain genre or format of a movie, like look at what's happened with all these, you know, cartoon or these superhero movies.
Well, and the musicals really like took off after Chicago.
Right.
Was such a big hit. And
so yeah. I would not be surprised if a lot of either older artists who, as I said, maybe not even that well known, someone like Elvis. I mean, if you're 20 years old, you don't know who Elvis is. In real impact, you know what I mean? You know who he is. You've heard his name. You may have heard a song or two. I mean, I had to laugh when I was watching some of the Grammys, and I saw the Jennifer Lopez Motown tribute.
Yeah.
And I had to laugh when they were, you know, because then in that show, they just show the audience more than they show the performers. I don't need to see Taylor Swift lip syncing. Show me the people on the stage.
Right.
They're showing the people in the crowd singing along or moving and dancing. I don't need to see that. Show me what's going on the stage. But anyway, the funny part was when they would cut to the audience, most of the young people in the audience did not know any of the words.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
To some of these amazing Motown songs, which you would think are just, you know, common knowledge, you know. ABC and Heard It Through the Grapevine and Tears of a Clown or Tracks of My Tear. I mean, you know, Dancing in the Streets. You would think that, oh my God, everybody knows these Motown songs. And you could see the majority of the young people in that audience and even the musicians.
Right.
They did not know, though. They were moving. They were moving their shoulders, but they didn't know the words. So, I mean, I think right now with Bohemian Rhapsody, the fact that it won so many, I mean, won four Oscars, I mean, there's no, tonight now, I'm sure that somebody at every, I'm sure the next day at every studio in Hollywood, they said, okay, go get me a, go get me a classic rock book and let's start paging through and see who looks cool and whose story is either not known. Or, you know, and I mean, you're going to see a ton of these, which, of course, then is now then going to, once again, dilute the talent pool. And you're going to see a lot of quick out movies that are just done for the sake of doing them. And then those are going to fade away. But like I said, I'm, you know, aside from my personal interest with the Elton John thing, it's going to be very interesting to see how they, because, I mean, if you think about some of the, you know, the great biography movies of all time, many of them, gosh, the ones that were made in the 40s and 50s, I mean, they made stuff up.
They made stuff up.
Yeah, I mean, some of these things never even happened in people's lives. You know, this whole story of Babe Ruth hitting home runs for people in hospitals, it's like, that never really happened.
I didn't even know that was like a...
Oh yeah. Well, okay. That's my point. But one of the great you know, biopics is a movie called Pride of the Yankees with Gary Cooper, and it's about Lou Gehrig. And you know, it's got this sad ending because he winds up with ALS, which they never even mention. They don't even mention what he has, you know, back in those days.
Because back in those, that's why it was called Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah, right.
They didn't know what it was.
But I mean, if you watch movies from the 60s and even into the early and mid 70s, if you watch Love Story, I don't think they even mentioned the word cancer. That was very...
I've seen Love Story, but it's been a while.
Yeah, so but they, a lot of times, like the one of the great movies that was a TV movie was Brian's Song. Right?
Yes, I
with James Caan. If you watch Brian's Song, they never mention, like, throughout the whole, I think at the very end, when they do, like, a Brian Piccolo died at age 27. But they throughout the movie, like, when the characters are talking, they never mention cancer, really. That was kind of a taboo subject. They made inferences to what he had. Or what these people had, but they never would say cancer. It was almost like this taboo thing. But like in the Lou Gehrig story, I mean, you know, it's a great movie because Gary Cooper is just great in it. But from what I understand, most of this stuff in his life, these incidents that they show never really happened. It made for a great story.
Right.
You know. And so, like I said, I think you can't get away with that today. Everybody's fact-checking.
No, there's too much documentation about things everywhere. Like, you just can't.
But it's going to be interesting to see, as I said, how this Rocket Man thing is accepted. As I said, visually, I think they've done a great job, just as somebody who knows and has followed Elton's career as closely as I have. I can get past the fact that they didn't get the costumes right. But that's not, and that wasn't their point. But in terms of recreating the visual look of the different eras, I think they've done a good job. So we'll see how the script is, how the story's told, and if people, you know, Moulin Rouge was a very popular movie.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
but that was 20.
Nicole Kidman won a couple of awards.
Yeah, that was 20 years ago.
Oh, gosh, don't even say that. See, now you're really depressing me.
So my point is, sadly, you know, you would think that that people's tastes and abilities to grasp things would be more sophisticated with time, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
If anything, what the internet has exposed with all this stuff is that the majority of people really don't have much of a sense of humor. And they really don't understand parody or satire.
Right.
They don't get it. They're like, that's crazy. Well, no, that's the joke. You know, I mean, please read Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal. He's not really talking about eating babies. I mean, that would never happen. You couldn't get away with that today. People would say, this is outrageous. You know, and that's the point, is that I think that people... You know, you if you're sitting there writing something or creating something, you say, oh, well, people will get this. It's like, don't know.
Everybody gets upset.
I know. Everybody's upset offended today by anything. So it'll be interesting to see.
Well, I'll tell you what. In our grand tradition of never seeing any of the films that are nominated for Oscars before the Oscars.
Well, that would be no fun. Now, I mean, fun is it predicting about a movie that you've seen?
I know. So now that the Oscars are behind us, I am actually planning to watch Bohemian Rhapsody this weekend because now many of the Oscar nominated films are now hitting the on-demand services. And I did happen to note that Bohemian Rhapsody is on there. So I've decided that I'm going to find some time this weekend and I'm going to sit down and watch it. So we'll see.
Yeah, well let me know. I'm probably going to try to watch it too. I did not see it, but
now we can watch it. Now that the Oscars,
now that it's over.
All
now
of these movies.
Well, no, because I don't want to be taken in by all the hype.
God forbid.
Yeah. But the funny thing is that we've spoken a little more than an hour, and we did not talk about what I expected to talk about.
Oh boy.
We did not mention Spike Lee, so we will at all. So, I mean, what's funny is initially I wanted to talk about this Freddie Mercury thing, but then the Spike Lee thing came up, and I will just, so now we will talk about that next time. But I will just tease you in that.
Just gives me more time to review.
Right. But if you listen to episode 144, You will hear Emily and I talk about our long shot Oscar predictions. And in that, I say that I think Spike Lee will win an Oscar. Now, yes, I understand. Wait. I understand that I did say that he would maybe win for Best Picture or Best Director. But he was also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, which he did win. And my whole point is that I think after 30-some years, Spike Lee will finally get an Oscar. Now that I know I said. I know I initially said my long shot would be.
Yeah.
Okay. First of all,
I mean, are we going to get into it? Or
well, let me just say this. No, we won't get into it because it's a whole discussion.
It's a whole thing.
But I will just say this. And I didn't know that you were not watching the Academy Awards live. Now that I know,
I was on a slight delay, but it wasn't by much. There was a point where I was.
Okay, did you see Spike Lee win?
Yes, of course I did.
Okay, you saw it live, right?
I don't remember it. I mean, if it was later in the program, then yeah, I probably saw that part.
Okay, because I'm sitting here when he wins. I mean, I'm jumping. I'm going yes, prediction. I am doing a victory lap.
I'm biting my tongue.
I am doing a victory lap in my house. And then I say, oh my God, Emily's got to be going crazy right now.
No, not at all.
And so, wait. So then I go on my computer because I'm like, well, she has to have written me an email.
No.
That says, OMG. And I go on.
You know what I have to say to that? No, OMG.
And I go on and I get to my Facebook page and I go to my Messenger and I click on and I'm waiting to see the Emily Arminetti and no message. And I'm like, right. What the hell is that? I mean, I made a long shot prediction.
No, you did not.
Well, we will talk about this in greater detail.
We'll just have to put a pin in it. We'll put a pin in it.
Put it in Pinterest.
Yeah.
But so, folks, what you're hearing right now, you will hear more of this debate. And if it wasn't so politically incorrect, I would use the classic line from Saturday Night Live. And Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin. But I will not say that. Emily, you ignorant blank. No. You can't do that anymore. But, wow, if this was only 1992, would I have done that to you right now? But anyway, so we will talk about Spike Lee and my amazing long shot prediction that did come true, regardless of what some doubters, some flat earthers think.
Haters.
Haters, flat earthers, those afraid to see reality.
Earthers.
Yeah. Those afraid to both see reality as well as admit defeat. And also admit that someone else made an amazing prediction because that was a huge long shot.
Oh, okay. All right.
You know, Spike Lee has only been nominated for a handful of Oscars. He had never won one. He was given one as an honorary Oscar a few years ago, but never won one. And he was not a favorite in any of the three categories that he was nominated for. And so the fact that I even mentioned his name as a winner is enough for me to claim victory. And so now we will, next week on episode 147, you will definitely want to hear episode 147 because, so do I, frankly.
I will be reviewing this.
I can't wait to hear your horrible argument. I can't wait to hear your argument and completely quash it. I am sharpening my knives and forks right now.
Okay.
Because
you should.
I mean,
you're gonna need them.
I will just give this a tease too. Even though I predicted he would win, I am very disappointed in him, in his reaction. Oh, so I will tease that. Even though I predicted he would win, I also could have predicted that he would be the usual Spike Lee. And with that, we will put number 146 to rest, and we will say thank you, Emily, and we will talk to you next time.
Thanks, Jim.
Beware. And so that does end episode number 146 here at Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted for your listening pleasure. Thank you so much for your loyalty and coming back on a weekly basis. We hope that we have entertained you for this hour or so. That's all we hope to do. And so hopefully we have done our job and you have done your job in listening along. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. And don't forget, this is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it is the only place on the web that goes from the end of the web to your screen.